Okay, today is Thursday, April 10th, and this is Lauren Bundit, and I'm interviewing Kent McDonald about his experiences at the Forest Products Lab.
How do you do?
Yeah. Great rainy day. So I guess maybe we'll start with a little bit of an introduction about you, maybe your education and how you ended up here.
Well, I was in the forestry program at Iowa State University, and I was looking for a summer job, and the same summer in 1961 that some of the graduates of Iowa State were also looking for some help for the summer, and a new summer program became available within the Forest Service. Coincided with all three things getting together. And the first summer was involved with what they refer to as the wood density survey. And it involved travel out west where we were sampling trees. And so my first job was to go to Colorado and go out with a crew and sample trees. When couldn't get any better than that. So, and later on, the next one was a trip to California. Spent 3 weeks in California, mm-hmm. at four different sites, and a good introduction to the Forest Service. That the people that were working in the field, as well as getting out into the timber and finding trees, and we would take borings of the trees and measure them. And in the evening, then we would do the measurements on the cores that we took out of the tree and decide which ones were high specific gravity and low specific gravity, and we would go out and the next day and mark those trees that we wanted another crew to come in and sample. And they would cut a sample out of the tree and send it back to the laboratory for further testing. So that program went on for years, although that my involvement in it ended after that summer. I was also working for a scientist, Max Pillow, and Max was interested in specific gravity and wood characteristics and how they related to all the different kinds of properties and the utilization. That was the beginning.
Right. And so was that through the Forest Service or through the lab?
Really through the laboratory initially, but it was a Forest Service wide program that for summer students. Mm-hmm. And there were about maybe 25 summer students that summer.
And this was during your bachelor's degree, or?
This was a year before I graduated, right? Mm. And then after graduation, they had a job opening, and I applied for that and got on as a, they refer to as a technologist. And that was the second summer that I started working full-time then. And my first job was to go with two of the senior scientists out to the state of New York, in north of New York City, in the Harvard Black Rock Forest. And at that time there were trees that had been fertilized in the 30s. And by one of these scientists, Harold Mitchell, and he was interested in sampling that wood to find out if what the 30-year effects of fertilization would be on the quality of the wood as well as the quality of the tree. If and if how much that fertilization stimulated the tree growth. So there again, it was a matter of finding the trees that he had fertilized by plot references and so forth, reestablishing those plots, and then cutting some of the trees and bringing back samples and test that wood for, and that was ash and yellow poplar and oak, and testing that wood for machining characteristics and strength. So that was the initial part of the first summer, and then we also went out on in the state of Idaho to a sawmill and sampled 2x4 lodgepole pine, tried to find out why some trees with certain characteristics might produce crooked 2x4s. So we started with the trees and categorized trees into whether they had a forked stem or a crooked stem or a off-center pith to the tree, and sorted those all into categories, and then ran them all through the sawmill and dried them, and then measured all the material that came out to try to establish if there was, when the mills were buying that timber, if they should get some deductions for certain trees that had poor characteristics. Mm-hmm. And that was the next project that I was on.
And so that was after you started full-time?
Right.
Just to go back a little bit, had you heard about the Forest Products Lab before you started in that summer program, or?
A little bit, yes, because we had graduates that worked here, that were hired on here, as well as we had a professor that was very enamored with the Forest Products Laboratory and what work that was being, that they were doing here and the research they were doing here. So as a student, we heard a lot about the Forest Products Laboratory.
And do you remember what professor that was?
Professor Dwight Benson.
Dwight Benson?
B-E-N-S-E-N-D. Just passed away here about a year and a half ago.
So we've already talked a little bit about your first summer full-time at the lab. Do you have any specific recollections of your first day here, or perhaps of your interview, if you were interviewed here before you started working?
No, I guess I wasn't really interviewed other than per se. We were a warm body that could work during the summer, and they needed warm bodies, and so we stood in line, or got in line and got hired. Mm-hmm. With more, and then after the first summer, there were other scientists here that said, we're looking for somebody like that to work for us. So kind of had an in already because they knew how warm blooded we were, I guess.
Right. Whatever. Willing to go out in the forest.
Yeah.
Great. So, I guess it seems like you've spent a lot of time out in the field doing research as opposed to in the lab. Did you spend most of your time here or elsewhere?
Most of the time here. And but the projects that we would work on involved going to either in the forest or into a processing center, either a sawmill or a woodworking plant or whatever, because we were involved with as much as anything, the utilization of the products that came out of the forest. Not so much the management of the forest itself, but mostly in the products.
Yeah. So what was a typical day like then for you? Or was there a typical day?
There wasn't a typical day. It was, I guess I would say there wasn't a typical day. It was, and for the most part, you were given a general assignment, or you either established what you wanted to work, an area you wanted to work in, and it was up to you to see to it that that project moved forward. So it was a good job. Nobody was saying, okay, today you're gonna test these specimens, and tomorrow you're gonna do this, and the next day we're going to the field, and so forth. It was a matter of if you're going to get from point A to point B and learn what you could about a product, that these are the things you had to do, and so then you would try to establish your program and get permission if it made sense from the division chief at that time. Usually we had good support from the division chief, so it was a good job.
And what division was it specifically?
Well, to start out with, it was the first summer was TGIR, Timber Growth and, or TGUR, Timber Growth and Utilization Relations, I think is the name of it. And then they, typical government, they want to have new name changes and keep people off guard, I guess. They changed it to Wood Quality Relation, Wood Quality Research, WQR.
And I guess, were there any particular projects that you found particularly interesting?
Well, I guess I'd have to say that they were definitely interesting, because they were projects that I helped initiate in areas that I thought were important to the Forest Products Lab. There was a need to rewrite a publication on hardwood lumber from standard log grades, and there were a lot of data that was collected from over the years, mostly in the 30s, that was in the vault. But had never been published, because of World War II and a lot of other things going on, that it just kind of didn't come to the surface. So when I was on board, they asked me if I would look at that and try to update the publication. So that was one of the interesting jobs, was to gather all that information and compile it and get it into a rewrite of a publication, which was the FPL 63 was the publication that we came out with. And at the same time, there was interest in Washington to have that kind of work transferred to another location within the Forest Service, and a lot of pressure from that other location to have it transferred. So we got involved in some I guess you might say pushing and shoving matches to try to see who would get it done and published. So we did. At the same time, there was some interest that we had a sawmilling project at that time, and there was interest in Washington to close that research down, because they thought they had gone as far as they could with what they had learned with sawing wood. And so with that in mind, I and two other fellows, Irv Boger and Hiram Halleck, we sat down to try to look at what a future program for the Forest Products Lab would, what it could be, and what would make sense, and what was important. So my suggestion was to look at using computers in making decisions in the sawmills. so that the computers would actually take into account all the things that were going on in a log and decide how best to cut that log up to get the most material out of it, depending whatever it was. Sometimes it was a 2x4 just for construction, and sometimes it was a graded board to get a piece of furniture wood out of it, and so forth. So we sat down and put that program together, and there were several around that really wanted to see us not get something like that going, and they were very skeptical that there ever would be a computer in the sawmill. Mm. But so we put together about a 10-year program as to what research needed to be done in order to reach that goal. Mm. And lots of spin-off came from that. That's one of the areas where then we had a Navy, ex-Navy man here that was in some, was in electronics, and I was telling him about how we might try to locate defects in logs. Mm-hmm. And his experience was in sonar, mm-hmm, with the Navy, and he said, and I was looking at it because there's in logs sometimes the grain spirals. Mm-hmm. When the grain spirals, then when that wood dries out, it tries to unspiral. Mm-hmm. So, and a good example of that is if they put a telephone pole in the ground and put cross arms on it, when it dries out, then the cross arms change directions. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things that we were going to try to find in a log, is if it had spiral grain. And I was thinking of the idea of just, you'd hit the log on one end at 12 o'clock, for example. Could you put a receiver on the other end and listen as to where it would come out strongest? And he said, sure, he said, you should be able to do that. And he said, at the same time, if you hit it on one end, you'll get a reflection back from where all the defects are in that log. So, well, that's fantastic. If that's the case, we can tell where the defects are as well. So we've got an internal picture of the log. Well, that kind of, that simple explanation from the Navy guy launched the whole program into where we started with ultrasonics and with the idea of eventually getting to logs, but we thought, well, let's learn what we can with ultrasonics and lumber, mm-hmm, first. And the spin-off from that was a system where we could locate defects in lumber. And then the spin-off from that was, if you can locate defects in lumber, then what can you do with that information? And so we had spin-off programs and people writing computer programs, which were very advanced for that time, mm-hmm, to get, if you had the information from a board, what could you do with it? Could you really make the decisions on how to rip it and cross-cut it in order to come up with? Mm-hmm. And so we had programs that we stimulated programs from that in a lot of universities around the country, as well as other Forest Service stations. And everybody kind of wanted a piece of that action, and everybody had an idea of how to apply it. So it fosters a lot of other research, mm-hmm, because of the possibilities. And the possibilities at that time were fantastic. Our bottom line was to try to get better utilization of the forest that we were growing, rather than getting just 50% of the tree converted into a product and the rest going to what at that time was called waste, but it was, and some of it was burned, very little of it was chipped. Nowadays a lot of things are done with the extra products, but the byproducts. But at that time they weren't. So we were looking, and the highest value would be in converting it to solid lumber at that point. and veneer. We had some veneer studies as well, but solid lumber was the most important thing. And our idea is if you could cut one tree down instead of two to get the same amount of product, mm-hmm. it seemed a lot smarter.
Right.
But to sum up that approach, since then, the whole Forest Service has changed about with the objections of people that think that we're cutting all our forests down. Rather than their solution was to just stop cutting altogether. And so a lot of our product was supplied from outside of the country and imported. So, and that's a big generalization as well. So that's not an explanation of everything that's involved there.
Right. Well, I suppose I could ask that question then. So how do you think people's perceptions of the Forest Service changed over your time working here?
Oh, a lot. The Forest Service itself changed within itself. When I first started, most of the forest management in the Forest Service was involved around foresters that had degrees in forestry, but they included geology, zoology, mm-hmm. and biology and all these other things. So then the change in the Forest Service, from my perspective and my opinion, but was that we started hiring all these ologists of every imaginable description, and each one had their own axe to grind and own ambitions, naturally. And so they wanted to apply what they knew about zoology and what they knew about geology and what they knew about wildlife and all these other things. So to me, the Forest Service changed within, and many tried to just adapt to what they conceived of as the environmental pressures from without. Mm-hmm. And essentially they threw out the forester and threw out the idea of managing trees for wood, for a consumer product.
Right.
And that's probably the biggest change that, as a forester, that was a disappointment to me, because mm-hmm. soon they realized that they really need to get back to managing trees. And the fire is just one of the
right.
problems that came out of that. And that came because of the change in policy to stop cutting trees.
Right.
And before, it was, we weren't even at to the best management techniques. We were getting there, but then in the 70s that started to change back. And so now I look at them as non-productive forests as far as products go.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's kind of a brief summary of.
Sure. Do you think it will change back, or?
I don't think it'll ever change back to where they have the kind of management level as what we had before.
Mm-hmm.
It's too rough on people's eyes to see timber cut down. It's not, they don't conceive of it as the same as cutting down a cornfield and converting that every year. And just the forest is the same way, as over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And those people need to go back and look at a forest that was cut down and what it's like 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll find out that it definitely continues to grow and just looks bad for a while.
Right.
And it's an easy thing to sell. You know, and they can fly over and show the devastation of a cut.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to convince somebody that doesn't look good.
Right.
But they don't go back and say, okay, it doesn't look good today, but 5 years now, you've got all these little trees growing,
mm-hmm.
and you move on. But
right. I guess just to go back then, were there other interesting projects that you worked on other than this?
Oh, many. Many. We got involved in one project, and that was in the early 60s, where there was interest from a company to, at that time we were making sheathing grade plywood, and a lot of the plywood came from some of the better timber, like Douglas fir. And in the very beginning, it started at that time cutting, turning yellow pop, southern yellow pine into plywood. Mm-hmm. But there was interest in northern Minnesota about turning aspen into plywood, sheathing grade plywood. Mm-hmm. And so the company, in a sense, paid for the research to find out if you could make plywood out of aspen. And so we went into northern Minnesota and sampled aspen trees and graded the logs so that if we ended up with some success, that they could go back and say, okay, an aspen log with this grade and so many knots and the distribution of the knots and so forth and the log size, that it would be the best to use to make aspen plywood. Mm-hmm. So it turned out we were lined up to go to a mill. Mm-hmm. And that mill was in Canada, and it was a mill that was accustomed to peeling birch. Mm-hmm. And turn that into paneling. But that mill burned down, so we had to change. And they found a mill up in Edmonton, Canada. And so they hauled, I don't know how many train car loads of aspen logs to Edmonton, Canada. And then we went up there for 3 weeks. And at night, from 6 o'clock at night, when the daytime mill was shut down, and we turned peeled aspen logs into veneer. Mm-hmm. And then grated all the veneer that came out of that and then put it in their ovens, and then they turned it into plywood. Mm-hmm. Well, what they found out, or we found out, was that the grade was so high of aspen, mm-hmm, that they could make paneling. They had enough clear sheets of veneer out of the aspen that they could make a high-grade paneling out of it, which was worth a lot more than sheathing. Mm-hmm. And so that was the end result of that project. And because the company then could not get the aspen material they needed out of northern Minnesota, mm-hmm, there were too many those that said that they didn't want to see the aspen cut. Mm-hmm. So because availability of material wasn't there, and then they didn't go into that venture of building a plywood plant. So, but it made some very nice looking paneling. Mm-hmm. And it made very excellent sheathing plywood as well. But at that time there was plenty of product being made elsewhere. Nowadays that probably would be a good venture to get into. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just an adventure too. But
yeah, need some of those. So,
and then there well, none of the others in particular come to mind as far as which ones are interesting. All of them were. We later on kind of carried the ultrasonic scanning to a certain point, and we thought enough so that it would stimulate industry to go in that direction. But industry at that time had no problem getting wood, mm-hmm, really. So, but they were interested in improving their utilization, and they found that they could improve it by quite a bit by how they cut the logs using the computer. So the log scanners were becoming, where they just did a profile scan of the log and took the actual size of that log into the computer and then made the sawing decisions from that. And we saw some big growth in the kinds of saws that would break down the log. And I wasn't directly involved in that, but kind of parallel to that.
And about when was that?
Oh, that was probably in the middle 80s. And about that time, there was another shuffle in the laboratory here, and I was put into a wood engineering section. And at that time, we were finishing up some work with the ponderosa pine industry. They were quite interested in getting better utilization of the very expensive material that they were cutting up for door and window trim and things like that. And we did some extensive work with them to show what a computer program could do for them, as to make, or before they were bringing wide ponderosa pine boards into a mill, and they would just tell an operator to rip it into strips, and they had a certain combination that would fit within that whatever width that board was, and they would rip it without respect to where the defects were. And we could show them that with the computer program that they could get a 20% increase in their yield if they would know where the defects were and make the best decision as to where to rip it. Well, that to some of the engineers, that they look at that in the industry and they say, yeah, that's sure a headache try to build a machine to do all that. And was at a big window manufacturer one time, and it happened that there was the company's accountant was in on that meeting. And when I said 20%, the engineer was just yawning, like, oh yeah, how are we going to do that? You know, that's going to require a change in the assembly line and the breakdown. And we've been doing it this way for 30 years. Well, at that time, they were consuming 50 million board feet of ponderosa pine a year and having it shipped from out west to Minnesota. And the accountant translated what 20% increase was right away of 50 million board feet a year. Of which they were probably paying at that time $300, $400 or 1,000 board feet. And he just leaned back, his chair practically fell out of his chair. And because he could see that that meant a lot, and you could put a lot of engineer time into investing in equipment to recover that. And that was a fun study. We did that with, we went out west and sampled the material at a lot of different mills out west, and ponderosa pine, just measured the defects and so forth. But the interesting thing at that time was we got involved with the molding and millwork industry. And that was a big industry where they were consuming ponderosa pine, which was became a very valuable wood, but also was one of the woods that they wanted, that turned out that they didn't want them to take out of the woods because they're big, nice looking trees and so forth. But one of the interesting things that was a real lesson was when we went to a mill in the Sierras just outside of Reno. And at that time, we wanted to go to that mill and have access to their lumber. Well, through their association, we met the president of that company. Mm-hmm. It was not a huge company, but they processed a lot of lumber. And the president said, "Sure, we'll go along with that. You can use our mill. So you just go there and you talk to the vice president. He'll know where everything is at. He'll know how to what you can do and where to go and so forth. He'll help you." So we went to the vice president and told the vice president what we wanted. Mm-hmm. We wanted access to certain grades of ponderosa pine, which they brought in shipments, and they'd be in big bundles, and we wanted help setting those out so we could measure them. Mm-hmm. Well, that vice president says, "Well, I don't have any idea what's out there. The person you want to talk to is the manager of the mill, the production mill where they cut all this material up. He knows what's going on." Mm-hmm. So we went to the manager, and he looked at us rather blank, and he says, "I don't have any idea what's out there." He said, "The guy you want to talk to is the guy that runs the forklift truck, and he's the one that brings all the stuff that we need into the mill from the big warehouse." So we went out and talked to the forklift driver, who was kind of the yard foreman, and Butch said the same thing. He says, "I don't have any idea what's going on." He said, "All I do is when the mill doesn't have any lumber sitting ready to go in the input door, I go get some more and set it there." He says, "When the trucks come in and the railroad cars come in, I go out and unload them, and I set them in the warehouse." So none of the four key people, or the five, including the president, mm-hmm. had any idea how this company was operating. And that was just a very typical example of how a lot of the industry ran. Mm-hmm. Sawmills were the same way. And they made money, and that's all it counted. Mm-hmm. And gave people jobs, and
right.
Hopefully nobody upset the apple cart. But it was quite a lesson when we found that out. But then we got into looking at different species of wood and what kind of structural properties they had. We looked at red maple, for example, as a underutilized species, mm-hmm. and to see if it had structural properties. So we sampled that, and one of the studies that we got on was going up into Alaska and worked with Alaska dead yellow cedar, because there were standing dead trees of yellow cedar up there that happened to be this where we went with Wrangell Island. And the buyers of the product of the yellow cedar only wanted live trees, and it was just kind of like, well, obviously you don't want anything that's dead. So but we went there to decide or try to find out whether the dead cedar was worth something if it still had structural qualities, and it turned out it did. So but that was a fun study to work on. But spent some time in Alaska.
Yeah. Well, actually that was going to be my next question. So you've already mentioned many of the places that you were able to travel. Did you spend any time working elsewhere other than the lab? Or
all my working time was at the lab, 35 years, yeah. Mm-hmm. Other than the travel, I didn't have any other employer. So.
And I guess where else were you able to travel? And
I was asked to go to Turkey one time. I went with two other fellows from the two grading associations. At that time, nobody else wanted to go, and it kind of trickled down from the Washington office to the Forest Products Lab, and I was involved in that area of grading logs and grading lumber, mm-hmm. and in the utilization part. So, and the problem at that time was Turkey's solution to people that didn't want to see their forest cut down. Mm-hmm. And the way the Turkish government, because they own all the forests, mm-hmm. what they would do was to go out and they would cut the logs out of the forest, and they would pile them up, and then the sawmills would come to those piles and buy wood. Mm-hmm. So the Turkish government decided that it would be easy to, all they had to do was to go around the world and buy logs and put them in those piles, and their sawmillers could come and buy those logs and could care less whether they were Turkish logs or whether they were someone else's logs. Well, they were buying southern pine from the United States, mm-hmm. and they were complaining, the sawmill people were complaining that it was already dried and checked, and the log that wasn't good quality. Well, it was probably 6 months to a year by the time the trees were cut in the southern United States and hauled someplace to where they finally could be loaded on a big ship and shipped over to Turkey, offloaded and carried out into the woods and put in piles in the woods to make it look like it was just mm-hmm. Turkish wood. So we were there to try to work with the top government people, the mayors of these states and governors of the states, to try to convince them that what they really should be doing, not cutting, not hauling logs out of the United States or anywhere, because they weren't going to arrive. It was like buying an apple somewhere. It's a degradable product that doesn't last in that condition. So that they really should buy timbers already sawn and then haul those over to Turkey. And no, they wanted their sawmillers, they didn't want to put their sawmills out of business, and so they just had a set idea in mind. And so we had some real interesting discussions and even arguments as to with the people. And they would look at me and they'd say, you are the U.S. government, you changed that. You know, and I said, hey, I said, we don't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, our government does not make those decisions, and they couldn't quite get across. And our government is, our policies are different. All our log grading and lumber grading and everything are done by private mm-hmm. industry, and not in all the rest of the world. They're all government industry, government control. Mm-hmm. Government sets the standards and does this. And it's very unique in this country that the grading associations do that and police themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, our government has been involved some in housing and really more setting up the outline as to how the procedure should be established. And, but,
so what came out of that trip?
They ended up getting sawn wood, mm-hmm. and as far as I know, but they did continue to buy, but they would buy in smaller shipments and get it shipped quicker. Mm-hmm. But and the industry, the sawmills, all they really did with their wood over there, believe it or not, was to saw it up for form lumber. Mm-hmm. So it didn't make any difference whether it was checked. Mm-hmm. They have a very low respect for wood, because all their houses are built out of concrete. Mm. So all they need wood for is to make the forms for the concrete. Mm. So they don't really need a lot. And I think that may have been some realization too, that they didn't, but their forests are beautiful. I mean, it was, you go into their forests and it was like being out in Colorado. It was quite a, and the food is fantastic.
I'll have to go there someday.
Yeah, I would like to go back because it, it was very unique.
Mm-hmm. Any other exciting trips that you had the opportunity to go on?
Oh, yeah, there's probably a lot of them. None of them just rush right by my mind right now. But
four conferences.
The best ones were, we did have, I was involved in the Forest Products Society and on the, as a board member there, and there were some very good trips to conferences. We had involved in, I helped or initiated getting the non-destructive testing symposiums going again on a regular basis, and that we had some, we had one in Sopron, Hungary, and another one in Switzerland, and the rest of them I think were held here in the United States, but they were people from all over the world that were interested in non-destructive testing of wood in various forms.
And how does one go about non-destructive testing?
Well, the ultrasonics was one of the things that got me into the non-destructive testing. It was looking at a piece of wood and trying to predict its qualities, a variety of qualities, depending on what it might be, either the strength or where the defects were, or the, where the wood, better wood quality was. And that program has continued in back to what the, initially what the Navy guy said was, if you hit it, you get an echo back.
Yeah.
And so now we continue with that, with work that's going on now by Bob Ross and some of the people here at the Forest Products Lab, where they'll try to, they know they can take a piece of wood, like a 2x4, and send sound through it and decide what the modulus of elasticity is, how it vibrates.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they're looking at whether they can actually look at the log and decide whether it has good structural lumber in it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they know that ahead of time, then they won't go to the expense of trying to saw it up into something that you're not going to get out of it anyway. So it saves on a lot of expense, and you divert that log to something that it's more useful for.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also looking at trying to determine what the quality of the wood is in the tree itself.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other side of it, in the other direction, is to look at sawn products. Maybe it's material that's been in a bridge for a long time. Or is it still safe to, is it still structurally okay? Because if it has some decay, then that dampens the sound down to where the sound won't pass through decayed wood. It has to have solid wood to go through. And go, the sound actually goes through the cell walls. It doesn't go through the wood itself. It travels through the cell wall. And that was the key to why sound and wood works so well, because it propagates very well through a wall, a solid wall. But if there's any fracture there, then the sound can't get across that air break. So, and other examples of that are mine timbers and things like that, where wood is used and you want to know that it's still structurally okay. Up until we started working with the sound thing, it was just a visual decision. Someone would look at the piece of wood and say, well, I think that's strong, and not really have any idea. But having some instruments that will determine that is a better way to go.
Right. So was the ultrasonic testing the majority of the lab work that you did in here? Because you've been talking a lot about your field work, which or did you do other sort of lab testing?
I didn't do, I guess most, I guess you should say the majority of it was that. But then again, you get onto different projects, and it was a matter of, when you're on those projects, just try to wind them up as fast as possible and get it into a publication. Mm-hmm. They rate everybody on the number of publications, and numbers count. Mm-hmm. Well, people can only add up numbers, simple numbers. They try to boil everything down to numbers.
Was that the administration here or in Washington?
It's just the way everything is.
Yeah.
It just happens that way. It's no matter where you go, you'll be able to say, okay, well, they've got it down to numbers. Because mm-hmm. that's the third grade level that most people understand. Right. And to try to get them to think about something. And I wouldn't say that I'm all that different, but still, you get beyond a certain point and it takes too much brain power to, so it's the psychology of the thing, I think,
right.
just drifts to that direction.
Were there any projects that you worked on that you felt were particularly challenging, or like maybe your most difficult day that you had working here?
I guess the only thing that was difficult was trying to figure out how to work other people and work with other people. Not that I had any problem working with people, but there were, everybody has, that you're working for, they have different objectives and different goals, so you're always trying to work your own objectives and interests and things that you wanted to work on in with how they fit with someone else's. So,
yeah.
So you could put it real simple and say it was a game. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the whole time. Okay. I didn't have any days where I didn't like coming to work. Mm-hmm. But
that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Were there any people that you worked with or colleagues that you have particular memories of?
Oh, many of them.
Particular stories about anything?
Many of them. I mean, they were. I enjoyed working with, there were a lot of people here that, not any, I guess, that in particular I'd point out, but there was a sawmill man here that was an expert in his field, and he and I were hunting partners and very good friends, and we'd stand toe to toe and argue about something till we were blue in the face if we each thought we were right, mm-hmm. and the other one was wrong, but we stayed good friends, but all in all, the people that here at the lab were a lot of fun to work with, and I met and I worked with many, many people across the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
Good friends.
Great. And so, how did you feel about working for an agency that's, I guess, part of the Department of Agriculture and Forest Service?
Well, I definitely felt good about what I was doing. I have my opinions about an overload of government, and I've got my own opinions about government workers. I don't usually include myself in that, other than I knew I was a government worker, but I tried to account for my time and as a benefit to the public, not as a hanger on. And one that was just feeding off of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided that my interests and things I liked to do were, I could do here at Forest Products Lab.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that boils down to where, I guess I was always able to play my own game.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, I didn't feel that anybody was leading me around, and that's that kind of freedom is nice to have. And it was the atmosphere of the laboratory, it was the atmosphere of doing research.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're interested in a certain area of research and you think that you can justify that and get the funds to do it and show that there's a place where it can benefit, then you get to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I felt very fortunate to have the support from many who would let me do that, and there were others that were the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And there were others that were jealous that you were getting some of the funds and they weren't, so
mm-hmm.
that you had to adjust to and accommodate as well. So.
Right. What were your impressions of the Forest Service, I guess, before you started working here?
Did you
go into the industry to start working for the Forest Service, or did you not have an idea of that?
Well, when I was in high school, I was always going to go into farming.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Iowa, and farming was what I liked.
Mm-hmm.
Then I decided that I should go to college and take something there, and had an aptitude test that was given, rather a simple one. You answered a lot of questions, and lo and behold, they came up and said, "Oh, you're interested in agriculture." So yeah, duh. What else? I answered those questions that way. So, but on that list of possible things to do with farming and number of things, and then they said forestry. Never had dawned on me that there was anything that even existed, like forestry. So
mm-hmm.
I decided then that instead of going to college in engineering, I would go to forestry. And I did. And one of the first summer that you're in the forestry program, you have a forestry summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
And ours, fortunately, was down in New Mexico. And 40 guys go down there and spend 10 weeks in the forest, and we were at an old CCC camp.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun. That's what 40 guys can get into, all kinds of trouble at that age. But one of the things that our professors lined up were visits with Forest Service people,
mm-hmm.
and rangers on districts and so forth. And one of the things that they stressed was that if you become a district ranger in the Forest Service,
mm-hmm.
is you usually move every 5 years,
mm-hmm.
because they think that a district forester has a lot of new ideas, and it takes them about 5 years to accomplish putting those ideas into effect. And after that time, they figured the effectiveness wasn't,
mm-hmm.
or his ideas were pretty well spent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Get somebody else new in and send that one to another district.
Right.
Well, I didn't like this idea of that I was going to be somewhere 5 years and then peddling off somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, it didn't appeal to me. So I didn't really know what else I might do other than I was interested in the products program. And then this possibility for summer employment here came up.
Great.
So it kind of fell into place for me anyway to
mm-hmm.
do it. Moved to Wisconsin, and I wouldn't want to go back to Iowa.
Yeah.
So
I guess we're sort of getting towards the end of our time. We're at about an hour right now.
Okay.
But just a couple of quick questions about your time sort of post Forest Products Lab. What made you decide to retire, or was it just time?
Oh, I got to the point where I decided that things were, that it was time to do something else. And there were still interesting things going on here, but I just figured that was the time was right. So, mm-hmm. And the possibility to retire was good. So I did that 10 years ago. January of 98. So, and then haven't regretted it a bit.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like you've been keeping busy, at least from our phone conversations.
Yeah.
And have you been keeping up with, I guess, Forest Products research or industry or just general interest?
I still do. Mm-hmm. There's a, you can keep do that, you can do that very easily on with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely stay involved with the internet. I've done some consulting,
mm-hmm.
but I don't, I'm probably not a good consultant in or as far as the business goes,
mm-hmm.
at least, and point it that way. Usually when someone has a problem, I'll look at it, and very often it's an obvious problem that they have, and but I'm too quick to give them the answer.
Ah.
But there's no business in that. But there's a good consultant will say, okay, well, we need to work on this. We need to spend some time on this, and time is money.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it that way. Or someone will come with the lawyer will come with a problem, and they say, this is my client's problem, and will you be an expert witness?
Mm-hmm.
Well, usually I'm not going to be saying something that I don't really believe in.
Mm-hmm.
If they're on the wrong side of the fence, which seems like most of the time they are, they're trying to prove something happened when you really know that's probably not what happened. So I don't, I just tell them right up front what my thoughts are. And,
mm-hmm.
and some will still retain you as an expert witness, but that's a game in itself too, because a lot of times you have two sides, each side. The first thing they try to do is to line up all these expert witnesses on their side.
Mm-hmm.
They're never gonna call them.
Mm-hmm.
They're just gonna have them on their side. So huh. It's back to numbers again. And if they and as much as possible, because I've had where I found out who's all on someone's team. Well, they've got all the experts that you would call as an expert witness already lined up.
Right.
And that's probably what settles everything is the other side don't have any of those expert witnesses, and so they just start throwing those numbers back and forth and scare off the other
mm-hmm.
other side. I guess there was a Trojan horse or something one time that they was so big that scared everybody or something like that. But so that I haven't done a lot of, I'd say I haven't done a lot of consulting, but I could have. But I don't enjoy spending my spare time that way. I
mm-hmm.
too many other projects, and
yeah.
I've got a forest and cut trees and
mm-hmm.
play around.
Yeah, sounds great. So do you feel that your work has left a mark on the Forest Products Lab or the Forest Service? Or
I do. Yeah. I felt that some of it I would like to have seen put into place faster.
Mm-hmm.
But very often, and we grew up that way too, when I was early in the research, it was research that was done 30 years ago was just being implemented. So it's probably much the same way. Very seldom do things happen fast.
Mm-hmm.
Our original thoughts of putting computers in the sawmills,
mm-hmm.
that probably happened within 10 years,
mm-hmm.
which was fast. And some of the other work, there were immediate, like the accountant at the window company, that was fast.
Mm-hmm.
But it was by accident that we happened to be talking when the person that really counted is the one that
mm-hmm.
Engineers and companies are really have their feet to the fire, and they can't propose and make big changes. They can make very little minute changes in usually what they're involved in. And usually it's like trying to cover themselves for the immediate time and look good, and unfortunately they don't get a chance to blow up a bigger picture that really can do some good with a company.
But mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't regret any of the work that we did.
Good.
I look at it, I could say, okay, it was way too much fun, and I shouldn't have had that much fun, but
mm-hmm.
I did. So
work should be fun.
Yeah.
All right. I guess before we wrap up, do you have any last stories or memories or comments that you'd like to report?
Well, probably a lot of them will come to mind, but
okay,
we could talk for another 24 hours and probably still tell new ones, but
I can always call it back. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.